Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It is a world of three-point shots and red-faced coaches screaming and crucial late-game foul shots and of grateful parents beaming because their hoopster offspring can get money for their studies. But it's a world of ponytails and gals instead of buddies. Joining us now on the line from her home in Kansas City is Michelle Vopel, who covers women's college basketball for the Kansas City Star and for ESPN.com. Michelle, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, thank you.
For folks familiar with women's college basketball, it's a little odd to see Duke and Kansas State ranked 1 and 2, isn't it?
A little odd and a little neat, I think. It's always nice to see some different teams at the top of the rankings and see how the depth in women's college basketball that's really kind of blossomed in the last 10 years has affected various programs.
What is it that has enabled Duke to climb to number one, at least in the polls?
The absolutely fantastic work of their coaching staff. They went out. Gail Gessenkors started at that program when it was not even a factor in its own conference, and has slowly built the talent base, and that's what you have to do. She's worked extremely hard with recruiting and getting a great recruit like an Elena Beard, who is, you know, right now, right there, is one of the best players in the country, maybe the best player in the country. When you build up that talent base, that helps you get your foot in the door to the next talented kid, and that's what it's come down to.
Many casual fans may not be entirely familiar with Kansas State and Louisiana State, but both schools ranked number 2 and 3, respectively, should be contenders for a national title. Can you tell us a little bit about each of them?
I think that the neat thing about both those programs is they're built with players, with many players that are from their home states. It's homegrown talent that's doing it. And it's not just talent, it's national-level talent. For years, those teams might get the best kids in their state, but those kids might not be on par with the best kids in the country. Mm-hmm. And in this case, both of those schools have players who are as good as any players in the country who happen to be from those states. And that's really a big thing for a fan base, especially at Kansas State. It's just made this state fall in love with its women's basketball program in a way that I've never seen in the 6 years that I've been in Kansas City.
UConn, the University of Connecticut defending NCAA champion, could be said to be rebuilding, if UConn ever really has to rebuild. The coach there, Gino Auriemma, said recently that it would be great to have a team of players so young that they would actually listen to him because they haven't heard everything he has to say before. Is he just making the best of a challenging situation?
No, I actually think they're going to be very good. They got the best recruiting class in the country last year. They've got Diana Taurasi, who's a fantastic player and a preseason consensus All-American. And they lost their exhibition game. Everybody was, you know, a lot of UConn fans are panicking, but I don't think that's anything to worry about. They're going to be an extremely good team, and maybe not as good a team as a team that had 4 first-round WNBA draft choices, but still pretty darn good. They're going to be right there at the end of the year.
Not only are there new teams in the top 5 in the polls, there are several new coaches replacing old ones and several old coaches going to new schools. What new old coach in an old new school are you going to try and keep an eye on this year?
I think everybody's going to be watching Jim Foster at Ohio State because that's a state that has just been a gold mine in talent. And a lot of it hasn't gone to Ohio State. You think back to the last huge superstar that went to Ohio State. And I might be missing somebody, but the last one I can think of was Katie Smith. That was almost a decade ago. It's a program that had terrible injury problems, and I don't know what all else has happened to sort of keep them from being at the top level. But if you look at the talent in that state, the resources, the commitment, the fan base, what he might be able to do there is bring that program right back up there and keep a lot of that talent in state.
At the risk of being parochial, I want to mention that Boston College is fairly highly regarded this season. BC has a number of fifth-year seniors. Does the tendency of female players to stay in school make the recruiting job of the coach of a women's team different from the job of a coach of a men's team?
Oh, I think absolutely. The men are looking at a two-year turnover so often now. I mean, for a while that was, okay, the very, very best. Now, I mean, you might say most of the guys that you're going to get, if you're at a top program, you're going to be wondering if they're going to be there much more than 2 years. So I do think that makes a difference because the women are still recruiting, I guess, and you'd say the old-fashioned way of having a kid around for 4 or possibly 5 years. And they're thinking along those terms. I think men, it's almost like, you know, I don't know how those guys concentrate on anything but recruiting. I mean, that's a shark-like world right there. As much as the women's is, I think with the men's it is even more.
There would seem to be numerous reasons for fans of the women's game to be terrifically excited this time around.
Yeah, every year I always think I can't get more excited about it or more interested in it or just more passionate about it, and every year I seem to, and I think fans probably feel the same way.
Michelle Vopel covers women's college basketball for the Kansas City Star and for ESPN.com. Michelle, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
The home court advantage, perhaps the surest measure of its influence, comes when one examines the fortunes of a team with no home court. That's the fate of the allegedly all-star exhibition squads created to travel the land, warming up college basketball teams for their regular seasons. Wyoming Public Radio's Rennie McKay has this report on one of those teams.
As fans file into the arena auditorium for the University of Wyoming Cowboys' second exhibition match of the season, the EA Sports All-Stars loosen up. This is their 11th game of the year, 5th in 5 days, and 2nd in 24 hours. And if that schedule wasn't enough to tire out the players, the All-Stars, on a permanent road trip, never get any of the other comforts of home.
Next score, number 5, 6'4" from Alabama Huntsville, Joe Smith.
The All-Stars are used to getting booed on the road, but the crowd warms when Ronel Mingo, a former Cowboy and current member of the All-Stars, is reintroduced to the fans in Laramie. Mingo manages to smile when he describes his life of late.
All I gotta say is just a lot of flying. A lot of flying, you know what I mean? It's been busy. You gotta get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. We have a game starting like on the 12th, you know, I mean, we have 9 games in a row. So that means we have to get up in the morning and fly out early in the morning at 5 o'clock. So basically, you ain't really getting no sleep, you know. It's just kind of hard on us, basically.
Mingo finished his collegiate career last year and is a typical member of the All-Stars, recently out of school and never a standout. He also had a typical attitude towards exhibition teams when he was in college.
I mean, I just think of him like as a nobody team, basically. Just come out and just try to kill him. Like, you know, when we were here last year, we played against him. We killed him by, like, 50 points or something like that, you know. But I pretty much think of it, you know, as an easy win, basically.
Brett McFaul is another former Cowboy and one of Mingo's teammates on the All-Stars. McFaul says he always knew he was in for an easy win when he played against exhibition teams in school. Now he's even more familiar with the losing ways of exhibition teams.
First game of the season would be Utah. We've lost 9 straight. We're 1-9.
The All-Stars record isn't unusual. There are 5 EA All-Star teams. They played 68 games this fall, winning 15 of them. Pete Cassidy is in his 7th year coaching exhibition teams. Like the coaches of other teams around the country, Cassidy only had 3 days of practice with his players before heading out on the road.
We don't call any plays. We have no plays to call. Well, we have, I was telling somebody earlier, we had 3 out-of-bounds plays, but they can only remember 1.
Despite the laissez-faire brand of basketball, the losing, and all the traveling, the team still has fun. Cassidy admits the team's attitude is fairly standard for this late in the schedule.
It always starts out, everybody's alive, have fresh legs and all that, and then they get a little bit slower and slower and giddier and giddier. They're in a pretty giddy mood right now. The lack of sleep and a lot of driving.
The players say that's not the only reason for their smiles. Brett McFaul explains why he's enjoying this time so much.
It's great. You come to these great arenas every night and get to play against big-time players. And You know, big time atmosphere, so it's worth it. It's worth it.
And McFaul isn't talking about the money.
Some players get $2,000, others get $4,000 for about 3 weeks, so it's, I'd do it for free, you know, but it's great.
McFaul's basketball season is now over. He and his teammates played 15 games and won three. They played in eight states and lost to three schools nationally ranked in the top 10. Most of the players are hoping to catch on with another team now. Others may go back and finish up classes at their old schools. Coach Cassidy says it's not likely any of his players will make it to the NBA, but they have a good chance of playing overseas. For Only a Game, I'm Rennie McKay in Laramie, Wyoming.
Share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. As of the middle of this week, South Africa's president, Thabo Mbeki, had tried golf twice. His lessons must have gone well because Mr. Mbeki has announced that when President Bush, to the golf course born, visits South Africa in January, Mr. Mbeki wishes to take him on. He's making unbelievable progress, said Becky Kumalo, Mr. Mbeki's spokesperson. Mr. Mbeki has otherwise been occupied heading the non-aligned movement, which has campaigned against U.S. military action against Iraq. Mr. Bush has also been busy trying to line up support around the world for a possible war. If they do tee off together, one hopes the two heads of state won't make it winner takes all.
On the first tee, he'd always have an excuse. His back was stiff. Couldn't get loose. He hadn't played in many a day. His parakeet just passed away. Bogey Bob.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. For even more sports coverage, log on to our website, wbur.org, and click on News. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Direct Tire and Auto Service, winner of the 2001 Retailer of the Year Award by the Retailers Association of Massachusetts. On the web, directtire.com. By Toyota, featuring the Toyota Prius, the four-door hybrid gas electric-powered sedan, available at a New England Toyota dealer during their 13th annual Thanksgiving event. And by Merrimack Repertory Theater, presenting the country gospel musical Sanders Family Christmas through December 22nd. Ticket details at merrimackrep.org. 37 degrees in Boston. It's 7:20.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Ohio State University's burning couches and coaches of victory. But first, yesterday afternoon's post-Thanksgiving Day Classic saw Texas beat up on arch-rival Texas A&M 50-20. Which football matchup strikes you as the best of all the gridiron rivalries probably depends on where you live and perhaps on where you attended or attend college. But according to Dallas Morning News writer W.K. Stratton, the distinction of best rivalry belongs, in fact, to the Longhorns and the Aggies. In a new book entitled Backyard Brawl, Inside the Blood Feud Between Texas and Texas A&M, he endeavors to make that case. W.K. Kip Stratton joins me now from the studios of KUTX in Austin, Texas. Kip, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You make a case, or try to make a case in the book, that this is the single greatest rivalry in college football. What lifts it above all the others?
You know, there are many great rivalries in college football, certainly Alabama and Auburn, Michigan, Ohio State, you know, even USC and UCLA have had great rivalries at times. And this one is maybe the most interesting because of the different economic, political, and just kind of cultural things involved in this when these two teams come together. You look at the historical aspects of it. This thing started in 1894, and it's gone on a long, long time. You look at the political ramifications in some of these areas, the people involved with Texas state politics, and indeed national politics that have a stake one way or another in the way this game turns out. You look at the money interests that are involved and all of that. I just think it makes this the most compelling rivalry of all when you look at the bigger picture of what's involved.
You point out early in Backyard Brawl that at University of Texas games, quote, even the replays shown on the Jumbotron are sponsored by somebody and fans appear more than willing to hand over money at every turn, end quote. What exactly is the distinction between major college football in Texas and elsewhere and the National Football League?
Well, you know, I'm not really sure there is much of a distinction these days when it comes for what the fans are asked to fork over. You know, the tickets are very expensive. I think the big difference is that the players don't get paid as much as the pro players do.
I love the distinction, don't get paid as much. That sounds about right. The University of Texas and Texas A&M football programs compete on various levels, only some of which involve the field. I gather there has been competition regarding the size and the furnishings of the offices of the respective head coaches.
That's true. I know R.C. Slocum had expressed some serious concerns to some of the supporters of the A&M program about his office and how well it would do as a place for him to recruit outstanding Texas football players, especially when compared to the really commodious office that Mac Brown has over here now, you know, with this magnificent couch in it and all sorts of things like that.
Now, years ago, there was, I understand, a significant difference between the students attracted to the University of Texas and those attracted to Texas A&M, but I gather that that's less the case these days.
The schools are becoming more alike in their demographics. You know, of course, A&M for many, many years, for the most of its existence, was an exclusively male school, a military college, and an agricultural college. Now there are actually more women enrolled at A&M than there are men, and so those demographics are really getting much more similar. They, you know, used to be that A&M was a place where the sons and daughters of county agents and farmers and ranchers might go to school, and UT was the place where the sons and daughters of doctors and lawyers might go to school, but those distinctions are really getting blurred these days.
You also point out in the book something that actually surprised me or perhaps revealed my ignorance of Texas football, but as late as 1969, the University of Texas fielded a conference championship team that was all white. Was A&M any more enlightened at that point?
Not at all. And in fact, it was more than just a conference championship team. That was the team of Coach Royals that won the AP National Championship that year. It was the last all-white team to do so. Mm-hmm. At A&M, there were no black recruits on the football team at that time either.
That's amazing to me that it would have been so recent that that happened for the first time.
Yeah, it really is. It's something that both schools have had held up to them as, you know, not a pleasant part of their heritage. You compare that to, say, the University of Oklahoma, where Bud Wilkinson recruited black players as early as the late 1950s. So it is something that I think neither school is particularly proud of, but it's part of its history.
One of the traditions at Texas A&M, perhaps the best known of their traditions, has been the building of an enormous bonfire before the game against Texas. But in 1999, the bonfire collapsed on the students who were building it. 12 of those students were killed, many others injured. And yet some were outraged that the president of the university chose to end that tradition. Why was that?
Bonfire is a tradition that that many people who are involved with A&M feel embodies the very spirit of Aggieland. It is a unique aspect of A&M, this whole thing that's called Spirit of Aggieland. It's a kind of cult, you know, some people from the outside would say to kind of ridicule it, but It's a system of, of traditions and practices that bring the Aggies together, and they carry on a lot of these traditions after they leave school. And Bonfire was kind of the linchpin to that whole thing. It was something that all of the student body was able to work on, not just the Corps of Cadets. Many of the traditions at A&M are in the hands of the Corps of Cadets, and non-regs, as they're called, are not allowed to participate in that. And for many people, when that was canceled by President Bowen in 2002, earlier this year, actually, it represented a kind of end of this great tradition, and there was something missing out of this whole, what I call often the mojo of Spirit of Aggieland. And so it was a huge deal.
Kip, maybe I'm missing something because I did not attend a university where football was king and where everybody got depressed if the team lost two of the first three games in the fall. But a lot of the preparation for the big game, Texas-Texas A&M, seems to me to be alums getting so drunk that they think it's a good idea to urinate in the men's room sink or on each other's shoes. Would it be a fair criticism to say that some alums of places like UT and A&M just never quite grow up?
I think that that is a fair criticism to make of some elements of the fan base. Certainly, I was interviewed by the Christian Science Monitor recently about fan violence after football games, and I had to point to the growth of tailgating in the 90s as part of it. People really get snockered for several hours, then go to these games, and if their team loses, they're drunk and they're mad. And that isn't really the kind of thing you expect people who are in their 40s and 50s to get involved with, but a lot of people are still carrying on that way.
W.K. Kip Stratton is the author of Backyard Brawl, Inside the Blood Feud Between Texas and Texas A&M. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you very much for allowing me to be on.
For reasons which I hope will soon become apparent, the celebration of the Ohio State University football team's victory over Michigan last weekend was followed by the pepper spraying of unruly fans, the incineration of more than a dozen cars, the suspension of numerous students, and the arrest of students and alumni. Here to help us understand all this is Dr. Stephen Kahn, a professor of history at Ohio State, who joins me from his home in Columbus. Steve, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
I know that you generally leave the campus on weekends when there are home games in Columbus. How soon after arriving at Ohio State did you hit upon that strategy?
Very soon. I have lived near campus in some of the really terrific neighborhoods around campus ever since I got here, but it became clear to me almost from the first fall I was here that one had to evacuate on what's called around here football Saturdays, because the onslaught of fans, cars, traffic, noise, beer, and so forth was just too overwhelming.
I'd like you to tell me what you found upon returning to campus last weekend.
Well, yes, we had evacuated once again, and so had heard advanced reports about this past weekend's festivities. What I noticed first was just the vast amount of garbage strewn on streets all over the place, probably enough aluminum beer cans to replace the commercial air fleet of the United States. And then if you look a little more closely, most of the burning hulks of the automobiles had been removed by the time I got back, but you could still see pieces of burnt furniture and the scars where those fires had taken place. There were over 100 fires, large and small, set, at least according to the police and fire department. So you could still see some of that hadn't yet been hosed down and cleaned up.
Now, I gather from our previous conversations over the years, pulling sofas out into the street and setting them on fire is pretty much what Columbus is famous for on football weekends. But setting cars on fire in piles, that's something of an escalation.
Yeah, that's right. The sofa fire is a venerable tradition here, and based on some of the research that I've done, dates back at least to the early 60s. So for 40 years now, no sofa has been safe during football season. Tipping over the cars and lighting them on fire is really quite chilling. There have been some riots that took place a couple of years ago, which involved sort of general mayhem, but this sort of systematic, and as I said, I think there were close to 24 cars that were flipped and lit on fire. That really does bring this to a kind of a new level of insanity.
Were the students generally proud of what they'd wrought?
I have no idea. I heard an interview with one of these kids who, as he was being released after being arrested and charged with behavior, and his response was essentially, yeah, I know it was really dumb to have done, but you just get so drunk you can't help yourself. And I suppose that there's a message in there for all of us.
Ohio State won that game, finishing a perfect 13-0 season.
Yep.
And assuring that the team would play for the national championship in the Fiesta Bowl on January the 3rd. Would the carnage have been even worse if Ohio State had lost?
Actually, I think not. I have returned to Columbus a couple of times after a loss to Michigan, and the city is a kind of deathly silent. I think people go home bitter and disappointed, and then they plot their revenge. Riots tend to happen after victories, oddly, here. That's when people really want to get out and celebrate, and nothing says celebration like a flaming dumpster.
Now, will the suspensions and the arrests that followed Saturday's mess have any impact on how football weekends go in the future?
I doubt it. As I said, this kind of thing has been going on intermittently, as far as I've been able to research, for 40 years. And the problem can't be solved, I don't think, with different police tactics or stepped-up enforcement or aggressive suspensions, all of which I think ought to take place anyway. And I'm actually quite pleased that the new president we have here at Ohio State has been very aggressive in trying to find out who these students were and then deal with them swiftly and getting them suspended. And she has promised if they are convicted of any of these charges, they will be expelled. And I think that's exactly the right approach. But that's not actually going to solve the problem in the long term.
Steve, I can't help but ask, the mayhem and chaos and flames notwithstanding, do you plan to attend the Fiesta Bowl?
You know, I'm only a professor in the history department, which means I'm so low on the totem pole around here that I don't get tickets for that kind of game. So I'll be watching it on television.
What do you suppose it'll be like in Columbus while Ohio State is playing in the desert?
Well, We'll have a lot of canned goods already socked in the basement just in case things get really out of hand. But I think what will actually the best thing about this is the scheduling. School won't actually yet be back in session.
Ah.
And so the campus area will probably be a bit depopulated, and I think that's just as well.
Better than defoliated.
Right, exactly. Exactly, exactly.
Stephen Kahn is a professor in the history department at Ohio State University. He's written about football at the university, although fans there perhaps wish that he hadn't. Steve, thanks for joining me.
Thanks again.
You're listening to Only a Game. With reference to my conversation in last week's show with Peter Lovering, winner of the World Championship of Rock, Paper, Scissors, listener Caro Peterson wrote, "You assume all your listeners know how to play this game, but this one did not. Just what do you do with rock, scissors, and paper? What am I missing?" Not to worry, Ms. Peterson, actually not all that much, and I'm sure even Peter Lovering would agree. Several folks, including Karen Schroeder and Patrick West, both WBUR listeners, wrote to correct the statistics in the Ironman triathlon story, which we ran 2 weeks ago. The race consists of 2.4 miles of swimming, 112 miles of biking, and 26.2 miles of running, wrote Ms. Schroeder. She was kind enough to add, "Thank you for the great and unique stories you provide each week." Ginny Bills, who hears Only a Game on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, wrote about that story as well. "I was disturbed by the comments of the woman triathlete who had already had two near-death experiences but planned to return to competition," she said. "Parents have an obligation to stay alive to raise their children. Her attitude is incredibly self-centered." Wally Firesteel, the cowboy poet of Gary, South Dakota, wrote to rave about last week's piece about the fall fun ride in Hurricane Mills, Tennessee, by Hal Humphreys. "Such a story illustrates why I listen to Only a Game," he wrote. Roger Easton, who hears the show on WXXI AM in Rochester, New York, felt otherwise about that story. "I am extremely disappointed that you saw fit to report on dirt bikes and four-wheelers," he wrote. "In doing so, you are lending some level of respectability to those vehicles that are ridden mainly by outdoor couch potatoes. I'm sorry to hear you report on a damaging fad rather than giving it the condemnation it deserves." Your comments will reach us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can contact us through the website, onlyagame.org, or email us at oag@wbur.bu.edu. If you call 1-800-353-1860, you can leave a comment on the listener line. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com, and from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Landry and Arcari Oriental Rugs and Carpeting of Salem and Boston, displaying their collections, variety, and more than 700 rug photos at LandryandArcari.com. By TechFusion.com, 24/7 data recovery specialists, helping businesses and individuals get lost data back and securing existing data from being lost in the future. TechFusion.com, where data is never lost. And the Nature Conservancy, using science and partnerships to achieve conservation in Massachusetts and beyond, on the web at nature.org. Good morning, I'm Dolores Handy. In sports headlines, the Toronto Raptors ended their own six-game losing streak and shut down Boston's four-game win streak by beating the Celtics 98-95 at the Fleet Center last night. Earlier yesterday at the Fleet Center, the Bruins were center ice, continuing their winning ways at home, beating the Canadiens 4-2. Tonight, the Bees are in Pittsburgh against the Penguins. Join host Jackie Leighton on our next Citizens of the World tour to Vietnam this spring. Find out more by calling 800-909-9287. Mostly cloudy, warmer today. Highs near 50. It starts turning colder tonight, even colder tomorrow.
Sometimes picking out the right gift is the hardest part of the holidays. Here's a simple solution. For a pledge of $60, you can give the gift of membership in WBUR's Circle of Friends program. Membership benefits last all year and include discounts at more than 50 retailers around New England, complimentary tickets to special WBUR events, and more. Call 800-909-9287 or go to WBUR.org.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, fun-loving adults return to an elementary game. But first, a look at the week's sports news with our analyst, Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Yes, turkey's still in evidence, I see. This year's NFL Turkey Day games have, of course, come and gone, leaving one to wonder why bother. Do you agree?
They've got to do better on this. The first thing, the National Football League has got to get the Detroit Lions to be a better football team. Otherwise, this wonderful tradition of Thanksgiving Day football is really going to be an empty shell when it once was. The Lions are really terrible. The Cowboys and the Redskins was actually an interesting game because you got to watch, you know, the steady progression of Steve Spurrier losing his mind and not deciding what kind of football team he has. We would be remiss, and we never are remiss here, without pointing out that the throwback uniforms were very cool.
Excellent. You could pretend you were 20 years younger. It's great fun.
The New England Patriots throwback uniforms, the guy on the helmet still looks silly, and the throwback Lions uniforms without the lion on the helmet were very cool. They're a very sort of postmodern Fahrenheit 451 kind of things.
Following an injury to Green Bay's Chad Clifton last weekend, courtesy of Tampa Bay lineman Warren Sapp, Packers assistant coach Larry Beitel said Green Bay would have its revenge on Sapp. A stern memo from the commissioner resulted. Are we worried about this?
Well, I think he was fined $10,000 for twirling his mustache and snickering wickedly after making the comment. Look, this was a football play. It was a football hit. If it wasn't Warren Sapp, who people resent because he's a loudmouth, and if the guy didn't get as badly injured as he did, nobody would be talking about this at all. Believe it or not, folks, this is what happens in National Football League games every day. It's a good warning. Larry Beitel is going to get precisely what he deserves if anything happens. To me, it's one of these controversies that indicates that people don't really want to know what the NFL is all about.
Who would have thought that the campaign to hire a black general manager would so soon bear results in the NFL? Ozzie Newsome has become the first African-American general manager there. Do we thank Gene Upshaw, Ravens owner Art Modell, or perhaps Johnny Cochran?
Well, Ozzie Newsome at his press conference went out of his way to point out that this wasn't a knee-jerk reaction to that press conference in Baltimore. Right. Okay, fine. Good for Art Modell and good for the Baltimore Ravens. Ozzie Newsome is enormously qualified. He's one of these people that the fact that he didn't have this job before was an indication that Johnny Cochran lawsuit has a merit to it. And he's thrown himself into the fire. He's trying to rebuild a Super Bowl team from a couple of years ago. He's got an egomaniac as a coach and an unreconstructed brigand for an owner. If he can succeed there, he could succeed anywhere.
Charlie, we're nearing the end of an era here. On Thursday, consensus greatest NBA player ever, Michael Jordan, said that he'll definitely retire for good following this season. So which team does he play for next year?
As far as I'm concerned, he retired the moment the ball went through the net against Utah. This weird little coda to his career in Washington has dinged up his legend a little bit. Some of his peccadilloes have come leeching from the woodwork, and I just assume he'd never done this. If it filled the need to compete, he said he had a couple of years ago when he came back, fine. He'll go back to being an owner again. I'll believe he's retired for good when he's old and gray and sitting by the fire.
Speaking of basketball history, the Indiana Pacers prevented same on Thursday when Indiana beat Dallas, thus preventing the now 14-1 Mavericks from tying the NBA record for the best start ever in a season. Will we see this matchup in the NBA Finals?
No, and I watched that game, and Dallas still has the same problem they had last year. They're a show pony of a team. They play really well until you get into a situation where somebody guards every shot. Dirk Nowitzki was 4-for-20, including some incredibly bad three-pointers where he didn't even get one. He didn't even try to follow it. He didn't try to rebound. Frankly, Indiana was just tougher than Dallas, and that's been the biggest flaw in Dallas ever since this particular group of players was put together, and the jury's still out.
It was announced this week that Larry Brown will coach the 2004 Olympic basketball team. This can't have come as good news to Shaquille O'Neal. How does it strike you?
Well, you know, the big problem with Larry Brown, and you're seeing it again in Philadelphia, is that he has only a certain shelf life with his star players. That's been the case everywhere he's been, including David Robinson, who was the most solid citizen anybody will ever coach. The idea that you're going to put him together with a collection of all-stars for 2 months, it seems to me to be really asking trouble. And of course, it does beg the question, what does Phil Jackson have to do to be the Olympic coach?
Mike Tyson will return to the ring on February 22nd.
Oh, boy!
And he announced this week, quote, "I'm tired of being stupid." How can he have it both ways?
I'm tired of being short, but there isn't anything I can do about it. Who cares? I mean, you know, this is the fight with Tonya Harding on the
undercard. Yeah, she's on the undercard,
On the undercard. You know, I don't know anything about Clifford Atien, except you never trust anybody with two first names. Aha, see, Atien is a first name. People don't know how erudite I really am. They had their press conference at the Grand Casino in Tunica County, Mississippi, which I can tell you there's nothing grand about. Mike Tyson has slid so far down the food chain right now that he's plankton. If he fights, he doesn't fight. Who cares?
In another record-breaking performance, last week, 46,824 people in Bangkok made up the largest aerobics class ever. Is this a more remarkable achievement because they did it outdoors and in the rain?
Will you please tell me when this becomes a sports show again? Good for them. I mean, that's, you know, that's an awful lot of spandex. 47,000 people. I think the 50,000 person aerobics barrier is well within sight. Another landmark we never thought we would see drop in our lifetime.
At the Santa Maria Soccer Stadium in the Colombian town where Carlos Valderrama was born, a 33-foot-tall statue of Valderrama now stands. Are you aware of any statues of American athletes quite that big?
Not that big, except for the statue of Vulcan outside Birmingham, Alabama. Actually, it's kind of a cheat because it's only a 10-foot statue with 23 feet of hair.
And finally, Charlie, the Rat Olympics has returned to the campus of Nebraska Wesleyan in Lincoln, Nebraska. Next week, rats will compete in weightlifting, the long jump, and track. Track I get, but weightlifting?
Cheese. Large pieces of cheese. The great thing, though, Bill, is that the members of the International Olympic Committee do double duty because they also organize the Rat Olympics.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he wrestles with all manner of questions, Olympian and otherwise, here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Should you feel the inclination to send Only a Game a message, learn more about the program, or perhaps listen to the odd Only a Game that you've missed, visit our website, onlyagame.org. It is a baseball-like sport where you don't need the coordination required to hit a ball with a bat. It is a soccer-like sport where you don't need the stamina to range over a large field for 90 minutes. It is kickball. You kick a ball rolled towards you by the pitcher, then you run around the bases while the fielders try to get the ball to the base before you get there or hit you with the ball. Lots of people play it as kids. Some return to it, a few of them in earnest. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
All right, everybody, these cats are on point. These cats are focused. Let's keep our heads up.
It's 5 o'clock on a Monday evening, and in just a few minutes, another game will begin in the fall season of the World Adult Kickball Association, known to the players as WACA. Already on this small baseball field in urban Washington, D.C., the trash talking is underway.
The Black Stallions. We're the team that barks.
We are
undefeated.
What is that? Excuse me?
That's undefeated.
Yeah, we are. Stifler's mom will not lose. We are the best team in the D.C. DuPont Vision.
Two undefeated teams, the Black Stallions and Stifler's mom, named after a character in the teen movie American Pie, are facing each other in the fifth game of the season. 23-year-old Trevor can't wait for the game to begin.
I'm very excited. I'm basically just one of the biggest kickball fans in Washington, D.C. area. I root on my team. My team does well. We're full of excitement, and excitement wins ball games! Excitement wins!
For being one of the sport's biggest fans, Trevor is rather new to kickball. Or we should say, he's rather newly returned to kickball. Until 2 weeks ago, Trevor hadn't played the game since the last time most of us played it in elementary school.
No one touches Stifler's mom!
While Trevor runs off to join his teammates, WACA CEO Jimmy Walachek nods in approval. He's used to seeing adults acting crazy over a childhood game, especially the newbies, those recently returned to kickball.
They always have that same excited look, and they go, man, I haven't kicked a kickball since fifth grade. And they get this smile on their face, and the first time you see them up there, they're a little nervous, a little concerned about how they're going to do that or how well they're going to play. And they kick it and they get right back into it. It's like riding a bike. You never really forget how.
This year, Walachek put his career as an IT consultant on hold to become a full-time employee of the league, which isn't bad considering how the idea began.
Well, we were five guys drinking, believe it or not, at a bar down the street called the Irish Times, and we were looking for something to do on the weekend, and someone just mentioned the idea of kickball. I don't know if they really thought of it that much. They just said, well, I bet we could play kickball for the weekend, kind of like playing, well, let's go play frisbee or whatever. And 5 minutes later, we had gone from playing a game of kickball to putting the team together, to putting a league together, to putting a whole city together. And then in 5 minutes, it became the World Adult Kickball Association. And it has been WACA ever since.
Since beginning in 1998, with just 150 players, participation in WACA has more than doubled every year. Last year, 4,000 players in D.C., Virginia, Maryland, and California played under the WACA umbrella. Next year, Walichuk hopes to put 10,000 on the rosters, with new leagues planned in Chicago, St. Paul, Kansas City, New York, and Atlanta. Players range in age from 21 to 45. The most are under 25, and it's no accident that you have to be old enough to drink to join the league.
I can't say how many times I say, and we go to the bar afterwards, and we go to the bar afterwards, but that's really what it is. Like I said, it's an excuse. You come together for 45 minutes, and then you go hang at the bar for however long you want to hang out.
Before the bar comes the obligatory 45 minutes of kickball. As the game gets underway, Black Stallions pitcher Paxton Stiles, a three-year veteran of the sport, pulls an orange bandana-style mask over his face and takes to the field.
I got my mask on. It's like special powers, you know. Okay, what it is I cut the sleeves off my jersey, and I put it down over my mask so it looks like a little bandit. It's a little intimidating for the people up there sometimes, you know. You get in the head a little bit.
Kickball is a fully co-ed sport, though some suggest playground-type rules, like only girls should bunt to even things out. But Stiles disagrees.
Of course, with the women who obviously aren't going to be kicking as far, I'm not going to bean it at them, but I'll make sure it pops up in the air. Now, the guys that talk trash, like these guys over here, I'll make sure I sling it at them to try to knock their legs off, you know?
Though some players don't quite know whether to call for a home run or a touchdown, no one looks to be truly embarrassing themselves. That might be because, Walichuk says, kickball isn't all that hard.
Anyone can kick a 10-inch red ball. It probably isn't the most physical thing you could do. I mean, I don't suggest people to go and join a kickball league if they want to lose weight. You're probably not going to do that because you're going to gain more weight afterwards eating food after the games than you're going to really run it off.
Across the field from the Battle of the Undefeateds, Walichuk's team is preparing for a battle of their own.
All right. Blue, pick, odd or even? Odd it is. Pick up first or second?
The all-important coin toss determines which team fields first and which team kicks first. This game, in which neither team is undefeated, might be better described as the Battle of the Heavy Drinkers.
We are Taste the Revolution.
How'd you get that name?
We were at happy hour, and the Sam Adams Taste the Revolution thing was on the table, and Dan over there came up with the great idea.
Actually, it came from a T-shirt a friend of mine has. It's Betty Ford All-Stars on the T-shirt. Just got a notorious reputation for drinking well, so it seemed appropriate.
Now, does drinking well at all translate to playing well?
We seemed to play a whole lot better last season when we actually were allowed to drink while we played.
It should be said that not all kickball players are obsessed with drinking alcohol. Some have other things on their minds.
Is that Robin? Come here. Look at all the cute girls you get to meet playing kickball. This is why I'm playing. You're looking at her.
Robin has only been playing since this summer, but already she's hooked.
It gets a little bit competitive, which isn't that, you know, that's when it starts to get a little annoying, but it's fun.
Just say that every now and then. Just kickball.
It's a phrase co-founder Jimmy Walichuk repeats often over the course of the night as call after call by the umpires goes against his team, the Betty Ford All-Stars. Finally, after a few more squabbles, the All-Stars come out on top.
Betty, on count of three, Betty Ford for quitters. One, two, three.
Betty Ford for quitters!
There we go.
Soon, the night's arguments fade away as these kickballers get on to the more important part of the evening.
Good job, young William. Good job, Jeremy. You coming out to the bar?
Just down the street, at Mackey's Irish Pub, players crowd into a private back room. Mackey sponsors the division and provides the T-shirts, so it's only fair that the players come here for the after-game festivities. While his friends let off some steam, Peter Kearns, the vice president of the DuPont division, summons the microphone. Beer in hand, he finally finds the words to describe why he loves such a silly game.
It's a way to connect. It's in a city that, you know, connection is about who you know and what you do and what can you do to get me there. And these are just people who want to go play kickball.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Washington, D.C.
Remember when you were just a kid way back in fifth grade? Learning how to play the game that your best friends played. When it only took a time or two, till you were meeting every day after school. Well, the game that you loved back then is back again today. Everybody loves kickball. Everybody loves kickball.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. We had help this week from John Hoder, Greg Eklund, and from member station KUTX in Austin. Special thanks to Olivia Kahn and to Michael Garth, who mastered this week's mixes and more. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter or check out Adult Kickball online, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Waka CEO Jimmy Walachek, who comments on the sound made when foot meets kickball.
We haven't been able to really spell how that goes just yet, you know, that bow. It's just such a great noise.
That's about the same noise that's made when a cannonball hits your uncle's bare stomach, right? Or when a comedian tells a joke that flops, isn't it? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Get on the woman of Kelly's. Have a view ride. Everybody loves kickball. Everybody loves kickball. When the sun is up and the sky is blue, there's nothing else that I would rather do than play kickball.
Major support for Only Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR
Radio.
This is WBUR.